Chapter 38. 2 days passed, and nothing occurred. My watching seemed hopeless, and I resolved to try the effect of a disguised interrogatory. It might help to confirm my already settled conviction, if it did not elicit any new evidence. Seated in Berganoff's room, in the old place, each with a cigar, and chatting as of old on public affairs, I gradually approached the subject of the recent murder. "Is it not strange," I said, "that both these crimes should have happened while we were casually staying in both places?" "Perhaps we are the criminals," he replied, laughing. I shivered slightly at this audacity. He laughed as he spoke, but there was a hard, metallic, and almost defiant tone in his voice which exasperated me. "Perhaps we are," I answered, quietly. He looked full at me, but I was prepared, and my face told nothing. I added, as in explanation, "The crime being apparently contagious, we may have brought the infection from Nuremberg. Do you believe in that hypothesis of imitation?" "I don't know what to believe." "Do you believe in there being only one murderer?" "It seems such a preposterous idea. We must suppose him, at any rate, to be a maniac." "Not necessarily. Indeed, there seems to have been too much artful contrivance in both affairs, not only in the selection of the victims, but in the execution of the schemes. Cunning as maniacs often are, they are still maniacs, and betray themselves." "If not a maniac," said I, hoping to pique him, "he must be a man of stupendous and pitiable vanity, perhaps one of your constant-minded friends, whom you refuse to call bloodthirsty." "Constant-minded, perhaps. But why pitiably vain?" "Why?" "Because only a diseased atrocity of imagination, stimulating a nature essentially base and weak in its desire to make itself conspicuous, would or could suggest such things. The silly youth who fired the Ephesian dome, apostrophe the vain idiot who set fire to York Minster, the miserable Frenchmen who have committed murder and suicide with a view of making their exit striking from a world in which their appearance had been contemptible, would all sink into insignificance beside the towering infamy of baseness which, for the mere love of producing an effect on the minds of men, and thus drawing their attention upon him, which otherwise would never have marked him at all, could scheme and execute crimes so horrible and inexcusable. In common charity to human nature, let us suppose the wretch is mad, because otherwise his miserable vanity would be too loathsome." I spoke with warmth and bitterness, which increased as I perceived him wincing under the degradation of my contempt. "If his motive were vanity," he said, "no doubt it would be horrible, but may it not have been revenge?" "Revenge?" I exclaimed. "What? On innocent women? You assume their innocence. Good God, do you know anything to the contrary?" "Not one. But as we are conjecturing, I may as well conjecture it to have been the desire to produce a startling effect." "How do you justify your conjecture?" "Simply enough. We have to suppose a motive. Let us say it was revenge, and see whether that will furnish a clue." "But it can't. The two victims were wholly unconnected with each other by any intermediate acquaintances. Consequently, there can have been no common wrong or common enmity in existence to furnish food for vengeance." "That may be so. It may also be that the avenger made them vicarious victims." "How so?" "It is human nature. Did you ever observe a thwarted child striking in its anger the unoffending nurse, destroying its toys to discharge its wrath? Did you ever see a schoolboy, unable to wreak his anger on the bigger boy who has just struck him, turn against the nearest smaller boy and beat him? Did you ever know a schoolmaster, angered by one of the boy's parents, vent his pent-up spleen upon the unoffending class? Did you ever see a subaltern punished because an officer had been reprimanded? These are familiar examples of vicarious vengeance. When the soul is stung to fury, it must solace itself by the discharge of that fury. It must relieve its pain by the sight of pain in others. We are so constituted. We need sympathy above all things. and joy we cannot bear to see others in distress. In distress we see the joy of others with dismal envy which sharpens our pain. That is human nature. And, I exclaimed, carried away by my indignation, you suppose that the sight of these two happy girls, beaming with the quiet joy of brides, was torture to some miserable wretch who had lost his bride. I had gone too far. His eyes looked into mine. I read in his, that he divined the whole drift of my suspicion, the allusion made to himself. There often passes into a look more than words can venture to express. In that look he read, that he was discovered, and I read, that he had recognized it. With perfect calmness, but with a metallic ring in his voice which was like the clash of swords, he said, I did not say, that I supposed this. But as we were on the wide field of conjecture utterly without evidence one way or the other, having no clue either to the man, or his motives, I drew from the general principles of human nature a conclusion which was just as plausible, or absurd if you like, as the conclusion, that the motive must have been vanity. As you say, we are utterly without evidence, and conjecture drifts aimlessly from one thing to another. After all, the most plausible explanation is that of a contagion of imitation. I said this in order to cover my previous imprudence. He was not deceived, though for a few moments I fancied he was, but replied, I am not persuaded of that either. The whole thing is a mystery, and I shall stay here some time in the hope of seeing it cleared up. Meanwhile, for a subject of conjecture, let me show you something on which your ingenuity may profitably be employed. He rose and passed into his bedroom. I heard him unlocking and rummaging the drawers, and was silently reproaching myself for my want of caution in having spoken as I had done, though it was now beyond all doubt that he was the murderer, and that his motive had been rightly guessed. But with this self-reproach there was mingled a self-gratulation at the way I had got out of the difficulty, as I fancied. He returned, and as he sat down I noticed that the lower part of his surtout was open. He always wore a long frogged and braided coat reaching to the knees, as I now know, for the purpose of concealing the arm which hung, as he said, withered, at his side. The two last fastenings were now undone. He held in his hand a tiny chain made of very delicate wire. This he gave me, saying, Now what would you conjecture that to be? Had it come into my hands without any remark, I should have said it was simply a very exquisite bit of ironwork. But your question points to something more out of the way. It is ironwork, he said. Could I be deceived? A third fastening of his surtout was undone. I had seen, but to a moment ago. And what am I to conjecture? I asked. Where that iron came from? It was not from a mine. I looked at it again, and examined it attentively. On raising my eyes in inquiry, fortunately with an expression of surprise, since what met my eyes would have startled a cooler man, I saw the fourth fastening undone. You look surprised, he continued, and will be more surprised when I tell you that the iron in your hands once floated in the circulation of a man. It is made from human blood. Human blood, I murmured. He went on expounding the physiological wonders of the blood, how it carried, dissolved in its currents, a proportion of iron and earths, how this iron was extracted by chemists and exhibited as a curiosity, and how this chain had been manufactured from such extracts. I heard every word, but my thoughts were hurrying to and fro in the agitation of a supreme moment. That there was a dagger underneath that coat, that in a few moments it would flash forth, that a death struggle was at hand, I knew well. My safety depended on presence of mind. That incalculable rapidity with which, in critical moments, the mind surveys all the openings and resources of an emergency, had assured me that there was no weapon within reach, that before I could give an alarm the tiger would be at my throat, and that my only chance was to keep my eyes fixed upon him, ready to spring on him the moment the next fastening was undone, and before he could use his arm. At last the idea occurred to me, that as, with a wild beast, safety lies in attacking him, just before he attacks you, so with this beast my best chance was audacity. Looking steadily into his face, I said slowly, "And you would like to have such a chain made from my blood?" I rose as I spoke. He remained sitting, but was evidently taken aback. "What do you mean?" he said. "I mean," said I, sternly, "that your coat is unfastened, and that if another fastening is loosened in my presence, I fell you to the earth." "You're a fool," he exclaimed. I moved towards the door, keeping my eye fixed upon him as he sat pale and glaring at me. "You are a fool," I said, "and worse, if you stir." At this moment, I know not by what sense, as if I had eyes at the back of my head, I was aware of someone moving behind me, yet I dared not look aside. Suddenly two mighty folds of darkness seemed to envelop me like arms. A powerful scent ascended my nostrils. There was a ringing in my ears, a beating at my heart. Darkness came on, deeper and deeper, like huge waves. I seemed growing to gigantic stature. The waves rolled on faster and faster. The ringing became a roaring. The beating became a throbbing. Lights flashed across the darkness. Forms moved before me. On came the waves hurrying like a tide, and I sank deeper and deeper into this mighty sea of darkness. Then all was silent. Consciousness was still. How long I remained unconscious, I cannot tell. But it must have been some considerable time. When consciousness once more began to dawn within me, I found myself lying on a bed surrounded by a group of eager, watching faces, and became aware of a confused murmur of whispering going on around me. "Erlet, he lives," were the words which greeted my opening eyes, words which I recognized as coming from my landlord. I had had a very narrow escape. Another moment and I should not have lived to tell the tale. The dagger that had already immolated two of Berganov's objects of vengeance would have been in my breast. As it was, at the very moment when the terrible Ivan had thrown his arms around me and was stifling me with chloroform, one of the servants of the hotel, alarmed or attracted by curiosity at the sound of high words within the room, had ventured to open the door to see what was going on. The alarm had been given, and Berganov had been arrested and handed over to the police. Ivan, however, had disappeared. Nor were the police ever able to find him. This mattered comparatively little. Ivan without his master was no more redoubtable than any other noxious animal. As an accomplice, as an instrument to execute the will of a man like Berganov, he was a danger to society. The directing intelligence withdrawn, he sank to the level of the brute. I was not uneasy, therefore, at his having escaped. Sufficient for me that the real criminal, the mind that had conceived and directed those fearful murders, was at last in the hands of justice. I felt that my task had been fully accomplished when Berganov's head fell on the scaffold. The closed cabinet. It was with a little alarm, and a good deal of pleasurable excitement, that I looked forward to my first grown-up visit to Mervyn Grange. I had been there several times as a child, but never since I was 12 years old, and now I was over 18. We were all of us very proud of our cousins the Mervyns. It is not everybody that can claim kinship with a family who are in full and admitted possession of a secret, a curse, and a mysterious cabinet, in addition to the usual surplusage of horror supplied in such cases by popular imagination. Some declared that a Mervyn of the days of Henry VIII had been cursed by an injured abbot from the foot of the gallows. Others affirmed that a dissipated Mervyn of the Georgian era was still playing cards for his soul in some remote region of the Grange. There were stories of white ladies and black imps, of blood-stained passages and magic stones. We, proud of our more intimate acquaintance with the family, naturally gave no credence to these wild inventions. The Mervyns, indeed, followed the accepted precedent in such cases, and greatly disliked any reference to the reputed mystery being made in their presence, with the inevitable result that there was no subject so pertinaciously discussed by their friends in their absence. My father's sister had married the late Baronet, Sir Henry Mervyn, and we always felt that she ought to have been the means of imparting to us a very complete knowledge of the family secret. But in this connection she undoubtedly failed of her duty. We knew that there had been a terrible tragedy in the family some 200 or 300 years ago, that a peculiarly wicked owner of Mervyn, who flourished in the latter part of the 16th century, had been murdered by his wife, who subsequently committed suicide. We knew that the mysterious curse had some connection with this crime, but what the curse exactly was we had never been able to discover. The history of the family since that time had indeed in one sense been full of misfortune. Not in every sense. A coal mine had been discovered in one part of the estate, and a populous city had grown over the corner of another part, and the Mervyns of today, in spite of the usual percentage of extravagant heirs and political mistakes, were 3 times as rich as their ancestors had been. But still their story was full of bloodshed and shame, of tales of duels and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.